in front of her. She scrolled through more menu options before looking back up to Philip.
Okay, Phil. I've shown you something pretty. Now how would you like to see something really cool?
Yes, please.
Britt tapped the controls and everything went black. Philip's eyes strained to adjust to the light, but there was no light to adjust to. After a second or two, he saw the control panel emit a subtle glow.
Where are we?
Philip whispered.
Very, very deep.
Britt answered in an equally hushed tone.
Why are we whispering?
Philip asked.
I don't know. You started it.
She whispered, then added in a more conversational tone,
Nothing can hear us while we're inside this sphere.
Philip surveyed the vista around them.
I can see why you brought me here. This is definitely the darkest dark I've ever seen.
Britt said,
Just wait, it gets better.
As she hit a few buttons, and the darkness around them flashed and took on a greenish glow. What it looked like nothing but a solid field of black was now a vast three-dimensional galaxy of faint, light green stars drifting slowly around them.
What happened?
Philip asked.
I set the sphere to filter the infrared spectrum so that it's visible to us. Also, the sphere is emitting infrared, or else there still wouldn't be anything to see down here.
Why is it all green?
Philip asked.
Because it looks cool that way. Kinda night vision-y. I can change it if you like.
No,
Philip said.
Please leave it. What are all of these things floating around us?
Debris, dead krill, fish poop. I don't know, to be honest. They're not what we came to see.
What did we come to see?
Britt smiled.
We'll get to that in a minute. First, Gwen tells me you're from the 80s, right?
Yes.
Tell me, what do you know about giant squid?
Huh,
Philip said. Thinking.
Giant squid. Let's see. Sailors used to tell stories about them, most likely to impress other sailors. They used to draw them on maps. They made a really cool mechanical one for the movie 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Britt hit a button, and the dots of light that surrounded them started to move in unison, and all in the same direction, telling Philip that the craft was moving. The effect was much like driving in a snowstorm, or how Philip imagined flying in an extremely fast spaceship would look.
Are they real?
Britt asked, then added,
Giant squids?
No,
Philip said.
I mean, I've read stuff about big tentacles washing up on beaches, but that's mostly tabloid stuff. I'd guess they're no more real than the Loch Ness Monster, or Bigfoot.
Yeah,
Britt said.
Probably. Say, what's that?
She pointed straight ahead. At first, Philip didn't see what she meant. He squinted, and in the distance he saw a ghostly image of something. Something graceful and fluid. It almost looked like an immense snake reaching out for them.
Maybe an eel,
Philip thought. It was getting closer, or to be more accurate, they were gaining on it. As whatever it was came clearer, Philip could see that it wasn't an eel. At the very least, it was several eels swimming together. As they drew even closer, Philip saw some dark mass ahead of the things, whatever they were.
Were they chasing it?
No.
Philip could see now.
They're part of it. It can't be,
Philip said.
It is,
Britt replied.
It's Bigfoot.
Britt maneuvered the craft out from behind the giant squid, accelerating to come up alongside of it.
Cool, isn't it?
She asked.
Yes, very. In a ghastly sort of way. The way the tentacles move, it's almost hypnotic.
Philip watched for a moment, then asked,
Did you make it?
No,
Britt said.
It's real. One of the girls is into marine biology. When she found out about this craft and what it can do, she went off in search of all the coolest things she'd ever read about. We've got them all cataloged so we can come check them out any time. It's better than any aquarium.
Its eye is bigger than my head,
Philip said.
It can't see us, can it?
No, it can't see or hear us. It has no idea we're here.
Good.
They kept pace with the squid, watching in silence as it barreled through the dark. After a long silence, Philip said,
"Britt, I haven't known you long, but I've been thinking about your situation."
Britt laughed.
"Philip, we're deep below the surface of the sea, looking at a creature that until 5 minutes ago you thought was a myth, and you want to talk about me?"
"What can I say?" Philip said. "I just find some things particularly interesting."
In the low light, Philip couldn't be sure that she had blushed, but he chose to believe that she had.
"Look," he said, "we know that we're in a computer program, and knowing that allows us to play around with it to do things. Make things, fly, travel through time, that sort of thing. But, Britt, none of us knows how the program really works. We tell ourselves that we do, but really we just understand bits of it. We think we know what happened when you came to Atlantis for the first time, but really, we have no idea how the program handled it. We just know what your experience of it was."
Philip paused a moment to give Britt a chance to tell him to shut up. She didn't, so he continued.
"You're thinking of it as if your life has been an unbroken thread that just happens to loop back around on itself. But what if it's not? What if you are the end of the thread, like the rest of us?"
"But Philip, Britt the Elder is here. You can't ignore her. Believe me, I've tried. She's here, she's me, and she remembers everything I do."
"Or so it would seem," Philip said. "But what if, the instant you got the idea to go further back in time and create Atlantis yourself, if you had to, the program, whatever it is, took that to be the plan? Then when you transported, it triggered the plan you had created like a subroutine. So the program paused our reality."
"Can it do that?" Britt asked.
"I don't know. I don't see why it couldn't. And if it did, we'd never know. So anyway, it pauses reality and creates a second copy of you, which then runs through a projected version of events, seeing that there's nothing here, treading water for a few minutes, presumably, then going back in time and creating the city. Then the program blasts through a thumbnail version of the past, what, 100 years? Then, when it has the past laid out, it restarts the program, and you turn up for the first time, from your point of view."
Britt shook her head.
"Maybe. But I don't see how that makes any difference. And besides, that doesn't explain how she remembers everything I've done."
"Yes, it does. And it makes all of the difference. It means that you're the real you, and she's an imitation, created as a placeholder until the real thing is ready to take over, and her memories are being created on the fly by the program to reflect her past, which you're creating now. You've been thinking the things she's done affect you, but in truth, the things you do affect her. She's just a puppet you, being changed constantly to reflect the actions you've taken, or are likely to take. Her past actions didn't create you. Your current actions create her."
Britt thought about it, then asked,
"That explains how she remembers the things I've thought and done. But what about when she predicts the things that are going to happen to me?"
Philip shrugged.
"Maybe it's the power of suggestion. You believe she knows your future, so when she says something's going to happen, you make it happen. I don't know. The good news is you're not doomed to be just like her if you don't want to be. Britt, you can become anything you like, and she will change to reflect your choices. If I'm right, you have more control over her than she does over you."
"That is good news,"
Britt said quietly, as if not wanting to be overheard.
"What's the bad news? There is bad news, I assume."
Philip took a deep breath.
"There's always bad news. If I'm right, you can die."
"Which is why you're so worried that someone is trying to kill me."
"Yes."
They were both so absorbed in the implications of their discussion that they nearly didn't notice the hollow popping noise, like a champagne bottle being uncorked. A shrill, brittle, tearing sound surrounded them as the diamond sphere that kept Philip and Britt safe and dry was clouded by thousands of tiny spiderweb cracks. They had just enough time to realize what was happening, then see the looks of panic on each other's faces before the sphere catastrophically imploded. For any ordinary person, the implosion of a deep-sea submersible is an instant death. The violence of the event and the pressures involved will completely destroy the human body faster than its nervous system can register a single pain signal. Death is immediate and certain, like someone turning off a switch marked U. Philip was not an ordinary person. He was a subroutine in a computer-generated reality, and he knew it. As such, he had made modifications to his parameters. Philip was badly stunned. He drifted in the water, his whole body screaming. He was impervious to physical damage, but the implosion had felt like being hit by a speeding car from every possible direction simultaneously. Normally, on the surface, he would take a few moments to recover from this. Philip was not on the surface. He was deep under the ocean, and while the pressure was not killing him, it certainly wasn't making him comfortable. Philip regained some small portion of his senses. He tried to look around, but there was no light this far down, and he no longer had the sphere to create and convert infrared light into something his eyes could use. All he saw was, literally, a sea of blackness in every direction. The cold was not an issue. Philip's modifications to his own statistics left him with a constant, comfortable temperature, regardless of the ambient conditions. So, that was a victory. The oxygen situation was less positive. They had found ways to make people not need oxygen, but they hadn't found a way to make them not feel like they need oxygen. So the unlucky few who had tried this modification, or had it tried on them, spent the entire time feeling like they were suffocating, even though they were not. This was deemed so horrific that no wizard he knew of had ever chosen to keep that modification installed. So, Philip needed air, and there was no way he could swim to the surface in time. Because of the darkness and the pressure, he didn't feel like he was drowning. He felt like he was buried alive under a mountain of water, which was not an improvement. Philip flailed about helplessly. He was down far too deep to have any hope of swimming to the surface. He had no light, he had no air. He wasn't thinking in rational sentences, or even words, just fast, panicked images, one of which was of his staff waiting for him back at Britt's home. It was too long to fit in the sphere, so he'd left it. Without it, the shell program he'd mostly invented would not recognize him as a wizard and would not let him teleport to safety. It was meant to be a failsafe to keep the wrong people from using magic. Luckily, after the scare they'd all had 2 months ago, he had developed an emergency backup, a collapsible metal pointer that he'd modified to extend to the proper length for the shell to recognize it as a wand. All he had to do was pull it out, extend it, not make the obvious joke, and use his last breath to say the right spell, and he'd be back at home, safe. He knew that it wasn't possible to talk in any meaningful way underwater, but as long as his lungs expelled some air and his mouth and vocal cords formed the words, he was hopeful that the shell would recognize the incantation. Hopeful was the word. He jammed his right hand into his pocket, searching for the pointer. He swept his left hand in wide arcs with his fingers extended. If he could get a good grip on Britt, he could teleport them both to safety, but he needed to find her first. He hadn't had the chance to take a good deep breath before the implosion, and even if he had, the violence of it would have knocked most of the wind out of him anyway. His lungs were already aching. The pointer was easy enough to find in his pocket, but drifting underwater, it was surprisingly difficult to pull it out of his loose robe's large pocket. Every time he tried to pull his hand out of the pocket moved with his hand. Finally, after several tries, he suspended his left arm's search for Britt and sent it to assist his right arm. He grabbed the outside of the pocket with one hand, yanking the pointer out with the other. He quickly extended the pointer, then started whipping his arms around wildly in a desperate attempt to find Britt. His lungs were on fire, but he did not want to leave without her. His movements got more and more frantic. Finally, he realized that if he didn't get out of there soon, he wouldn't get out of there at all. His arms had yet to make contact with anything that might be another person. He was very quickly reaching decision time when he felt something grab his left foot. For the first time since the implosion, actual words popped into his mind.
"Oh, God," he thought. "It's the squid!"
Philip pictured himself materializing back at home with a 50-foot, angry, dying squid. He didn't like what he saw. He jerked his leg upward, but it was held tight. He couldn't shake the squid off. He knew that squid or no squid, he needed air, now. He drew up his other leg to make one desperate attempt to kick himself free. He looked down, towards his captured leg, and at first he thought he was hallucinating from the lack of oxygen. His eyes struggled to focus and adjust, but submerged in murky water without goggles, his vision was only going to be so clear. Still, blurry though it was, Philip definitely saw light beneath him. He stopped struggling and saw that it was not the squid that had his left foot, it was Britt. She had his foot jammed into the crook of her right arm, and the index finger of her left hand was glowing. They briefly made eye contact. Britt stabbed her glowing finger at a floating button that only she could see, and the two of them disappeared. 15. Martin and Gwen were waiting. They had realized that something was up. They wanted to tell Philip and needed to tell Britt. They decided that finding Britt first was their priority, and decided to start with Britt the younger, since she was the one in direct danger. They went to her home. Nick knew Gwen well and let them in, but was adamant that when Britt went out on her little head-clearing trips, she was not to be disturbed. Martin saw Philip's staff lying on the floor next to one of the chairs and asked Nick if Britt had company. Nick said,
"Yes, a gentleman named Philip."
Nick assured Gwen and Martin that Britt would be back soon and told them to have a seat while he went and got them some refreshments. Gwen and Martin had just settled into their seats when Britt and Philip returned. Britt had her legs pulled in toward her body, one hand pointing into space, the other trapping Philip's ankle under her arm. Philip had one leg, the one Britt was clinging to, stretched out and the other pulled up, with his knee to his chest as if he intended to kick Britt in the face. His back was hunched, his arms were akimbo, and in his right hand he was holding a metal pointer like he had just been giving a science lecture. They both appeared out of thin air, soaking wet and several feet off the ground. They fell to the floor with a wet thud, then lay there gasping for air. Gwen rushed to their sides to offer aid. Martin leaned forward in his chair. Once she had caught her breath, Britt leaned up on one elbow, looked at Philip, and said,
"Were you gonna kick me in the head?"
Philip shrugged and said,
"Sorry, I thought you were the squid."
Martin said,
"Well, there's gotta be a story behind that."
Gwen helped Britt to her feet. Martin watched, smirking as Philip clambered to a standing position, then wrung some of the brine out of his hat. Britt said,
"Thanks, Gwen. By the way, what are you two doing here?"
Gwen put a reassuring hand on Britt's shoulder and said,
"We need to talk. Martin and I think someone may be trying to kill you."
Philip turned to Martin and said,
"You think so, huh?"
Martin replied,
"It's a theory."
Just then, Nick rounded the corner from the kitchen, calling out,
"Okay, who's thirsty?"
When he saw Britt and Philip's condition, he nearly dropped his tray of drinks. Philip and Martin teleported back to their room so Philip could clean himself up. Britt used the time to make herself look and feel more human. 20 minutes later, they reconvened in Britt's living room to compare notes. Britt and Philip described how they had heard the same hollow popping noise when the submersible imploded that they'd heard before the two statues fell. Gwen and Martin talked about their inspection of the statue base and their belief that both statues had been brought down deliberately.
"What I don't get," Martin mused, "is why anyone would want to kill you in the first place, Britt."
Britt smiled.
"Thanks, Martin. I appreciate that."
"I mean," Martin continued, "Britt the Elder being here proves that you survived to be her, so any attempt to kill you is doomed to failure. Am I right?"
Britt looked long and hard at Martin, then said,
"Is that the only reason you can think of not to kill me?"
Philip quickly added,
"Besides, it's not really true.
He went on to give Gwen and Martin a quick synopsis of his idea regarding Brit the Elder's existence and Brit the Younger's killability. Martin thought for a moment, then asked,
"Is killability even a word?"
Philip said, "If I use it, and you know what it means, it is a word. Also, it's fun to say, killability, killability. It rolls nicely."
"I don't know," Martin continued. "It's not very elegant."
"The word is killability. Who cares?"
"No, not the word. Well, not just the word. Your idea, too. It's inelegant."
"Reality is inelegant,"
Philip huffed.
"No," Martin said definitively. "Reality is stunningly elegant. Our understanding of it is not."
"Martin, we're not going to have this argument again."
"We never have this argument. Every time we start to, you get mad and start shouting."
Philip's face began to turn red.
"You're right. I shouldn't have said we're not going to have this argument again. I should have said, again, we are not going to have this argument. Maybe you'd think that was more elegant."
Brit turned to Gwen and said,
"I can see why you enjoyed hanging around with these guys. It's entertaining in its way."
"Yes," Gwen agreed. "But as usual, it isn't really getting us anywhere. Guys, arguments about Brit's killability... Oh, that is fun."
Philip smiled and said,
"I know, right?"
Brit did not smile. Gwen continued,
"Maybe Brit can be killed. Maybe she can't. Either way, Philip can be killed, and he nearly was. Whoever it is who's trying to take Brit out could easily kill someone else in the process. We have to stop them, and that means figuring out who it is."
Brit said,
"We know it's someone with powers. Gunpowder won't be invented until hundreds of years from now, and even if it were, it would take a heap of the stuff to bring down one of those statues, let alone to put a hole in my diamond sphere."
"Agreed,"
Gwen said.
"Of course, this would happen during the one time that we have magic users from all over the world visiting. That won't make it easier to narrow things down."
"Who has the most to gain?"
Martin asked.
"Brit, if you were out of the picture, who'd benefit most?"
"Nobody,"
Brit said.
"I'm completely unimportant."
Gwen said,
"Brit, that's not true."
Brit waved her off.
"Yes, it is. Brit the Elder has all of the power. I get it. She's the one who's done everything. I'm just the one who's going to do everything. And in the end, what's that worth? Really, I'm only in the Council of Three to break ties."
"But you are on the Council," Martin said.
"Maybe someone wants you off. Maybe they want you and Brit the Elder both off of the Council, and they think that if they kill you, it'll take her out too. Two birds with one stone."
Philip said, "Martin, there are only two options. Either their fates are tied together, or they aren't. If they are and someone kills Brit here, then she never goes on to build Atlantis. None of this ever happens, and whoever it is who thinks they're going to gain something most likely loses everything. If, on the other hand, their fates aren't joined, then whoever kills Brit will find that the only change they've created is that the most powerful woman in Atlantis is furious at them for killing her younger self and giving her an identity crisis. Either way, it's a stupid plan."
Martin shrugged.
"Then maybe the murderer is stupid."
"Attempted murderer,"
Brit corrected.
"They haven't succeeded at anything yet."
"Which proves my point,"
Martin said.
Gwen said,
"Martin, you said we should look at the person who has the most to gain. Well, that's Ida, the president. With both Brits gone, she'd be the only council member left. But she's not stupid."
"Are you sure?"
Martin asked. Both Gwen and Brit nodded.
"We both voted for Ida. We wouldn't vote for someone we thought might be stupid."
Martin accepted this, and the room fell into a sullen silence. Eventually, Gwen said,
"Whoever it is, either they'll give up, which is good, or they'll try again, and that'll be a chance to catch them. Either way, I think the logical next step is to go tell Brit the Elder what's going on."
"Why?"
Brit asked.
"Shouldn't she already know? Having someone try to kill you is pretty memorable. You'd think she'd recall who did it,
how many more times they'll try, and how they're stopped.
Philip said,
Gwen's right, and so are you. Either she doesn't know and we need to tell her, or she does know and we need to ask her what happens next.
No, Britt said flatly. I don't want her to have the satisfaction of knowing that I came to her for help.
Martin asked,
And if you don't, you're okay with having her remembering that you risked your life rather than ask her for help?
Yes, Britt said. I'm fine with that, because that gives me satisfaction.
Gwen said,
Britt, if your life might be in danger, and we knew about it, wouldn't you want us to tell you?
You know it,
Britt said.
Gwen said, And that's why we have to tell her, because she is you.
Gwen tried not to look triumphant as she said it. Britt replied,
Then you've warned her just now when you told me.
Britt made a deliberate effort to look triumphant as she said it. She looked at the faces of the other three people. She could tell she had lost the argument, but that didn't mean she had to act defeated.
Fine, she said. We'll warn her, but it's not going to be me who does it. One of you three are going to have to deal with her. Who's it going to be?
While Gwen, Philip, and Martin all agreed that Britt the Elder needed to be warned, none of them were particularly eager to volunteer to do it in front of Britt the Younger. She clearly had issues with Britt the Elder, and might take them out on anyone who seemed to be elder-friendly. Gwen was her friend and didn't want to seem disloyal. Philip was beginning to harbor hopes of becoming something more than her friend, and especially didn't want to seem disloyal. Martin had a lifelong aversion to offending angry women. The three of them stared at each other, mute with indecision, until, mercifully, the doorbell rang. Nick speed-walked across the room, saying,
Don't get up, I'll get that. You keep having your very serious discussion that I was definitely not listening to.
Nick opened the door. Outside, there were two guards. One, Martin had not met, was wearing the normal guard kilt and net shirt. The other, Ampix, was also wearing an apparently homemade pointy wizard hat. When Ampix noticed that Gwen was there, he winked and flicked his eyes upward to call her attention to the hat. The other guard said,
We have been sent to collect the guest of Atlantis called Philip.
Britt the Younger rose to her feet and asked,
Why? What for?
The guard stated,
He is to meet with Britt the Elder.
Britt the Younger glared at Philip, who looked uneasily back at her. Martin smiled broadly and said,
Say, that's convenient.
Ampix studied Martin, filing this away for later.
16. The heat was unbearable. Agent Miller tried to get his mind off of the heat by focusing on the noise, which was deafening. After a few minutes of this, he tried to distract himself from the noise by focusing on his motion sickness, which threatened to make him throw up at any moment. In an effort to alleviate this, he crawled closer to the open door of the unrefrigerated boxcar in which he was riding.
Maybe if I look at the horizon, I won't be sick. That's supposed to help. Besides, it's cooler there because of the wind.
He crawled as close to the door as he dared, close enough to feel that the wind was still unnervingly strong and gusty, and to see that the train was still cutting along the side of a mountain, so that the door of the boxcar opened to a life-ending drop. Not a straight drop. There was a painful-looking gravel berm just wide enough for him to bounce off of before he fell over the side to his certain death. His innate fear of heights and his lack of any decent footing drove Agent Miller clambering back into the dark corner of the boxcar, where it was safe, hot, and loud.
I hate this!
He shouted.
What?
Jimmy shouted back. It would have been hard enough to hear each other if they had only had the train noise to contend with. But because of Jimmy's weird effect on electronic devices, they'd had to find a train going from Seattle to Los Angeles that had three non-refrigerated boxcars in a row that weren't transporting any sort of electronic devices, and in which the middle car had room for three adults to live for the 3 days the trip was going to take. That left them with a field of one car to choose from. This car, which was transporting tens of thousands of squeaky, bone-shaped rubber dog toys, manufactured in China, shipped by freighter to Seattle, now headed to a big-box pet supply chain's distribution center in Southern California. For now, the squeaky bones were held in large cardboard boxes that completely filled the interior of the boxcar to a depth of 6 feet, leaving them 4 feet of living space on the top. Not that they could stand on the loosely packed boxes anyway. The agents and their charge had taped several of the boxes to each other and to the walls so that they could have the door of the boxcar open a bit and not be worried about the cargo falling out unexpectedly and taking one or all of them with it. Still, the three men had to live in a moving, rattling, cacophonous metal box while lying, sitting, crawling, and involuntarily bouncing on a bed of cardboard and thousands of squeaky toys. The din was constant, but not consistent enough to become white noise. Any bump or shimmy on the part of the train, or shift in weight on the part of the men inside the car, caused a spike in the volume of the squeaking. Miller envied his partner, Agent Murphy. At least he had a means of taking an occasional break. Twice a day they had to check in with their supervisor, but cell phones didn't work if they were too close to Jimmy and his magnetic field. Being trapped inside a steel box with him didn't make the cell phone work any better. So in order to check in, all Agent Murphy, who had no fear of heights, unlike Agent Miller, had to do was swing himself out of the open door of the shaking boxcar, grab the ladder that was just within reach, climb up to the roof of the moving train, and make his way far enough away from Jimmy that his phone would work. This meant walking toward the back of the train and jumping to the next boxcar back. Two cars in front of them was an open bin of some foul-smelling material Miller suspected was used in the manufacture of fertilizer. Miller carefully crawled toward Jimmy, who was lying back on several partially mashed, squeaking boxes, as if they were a deluxe bed in the most expensive suite at the finest hotel. Jimmy was wearing his suit pants and a Seattle PD t-shirt. He had his suit jacket folded and tucked under his head like a pillow. It took great care to move around, not only because the unreliability of the surface made it hard to find footing, but also because it was very easy to carelessly put your weight on one of the seams between the boxes of squeaky toys, meaning that you could be crawling along without a care in the world, then trust your weight to the wrong spot and instantly find yourself falling headfirst between the boxes all the way down to the splintery plywood floor. If that happened, you'd have to crawl your way up, like a man buried alive, to the surface of your squeaking, cardboard-scented grave. Miller finally reached Jimmy. He put his head right up to Jimmy's ear and shouted, "I hate this!" Jimmy smiled and shouted back,
"I know!"
"How can you look so happy?"
Miller asked.
"Try being a middle-aged white man riding a bicycle through Nicaragua. This is luxury."
Agent Miller put his mouth right up to Jimmy's ear and yelled,
"I feel like I'm gonna be sick."
Jimmy replied,
"Please don't do it while shouting in my ear."
Miller said,
"I should be so lucky,"
and carefully slunk back to his corner of the boxcar. He could have stayed where he was, next to Jimmy, but the fact was he wanted as much distance between them as possible. Miller had begun to regret having ever laid eyes on the old coot. Miller thought back to his life before meeting Jimmy. He was half of a 2-man task force assigned to investigate and possibly solve a series of possibly connected impossible occurrences that were possibly crimes. They had spent years chasing promising leads and had always come up empty-handed. At the time, it was frustrating, but in retrospect seemed like some kind of golden age. They never enjoyed returning to their office empty-handed, but now they were returning home with their hands full of Jimmy, and it was just as unsavory as it sounded. Their original plan was to stay in Seattle. They would question Jimmy and decide if he was a crackpot or if he was on the level. Either way, they'd get the information they needed and get back to Los Angeles, toot sweet. Unfortunately, Jimmy proved to be both a crackpot and on the level, and instead of just answering their questions, he needed to demonstrate his point, and he had a whole list of weird household items he needed before he could stage his demonstration. It was like trying to interrogate Bill Nye the Science Guy. Most of the items on the list had been easy. Things like kite string, binoculars, a large scented candle. Things you could get at any department store. The problem had been the last item. A room at least 40 feet in length with a clear line of sight. The Seattle Police Department had no such room in their headquarters, or at least had none that they were willing to hand over to Miller and Murphy. The SPD had started to tire of the two Treasury agents, their weird informant, and the rash of unexplained electronic malfunctions that followed him wherever he went. Murphy had tried to find another facility in Seattle that met Jimmy's specifications, but they all suffered from the same flaw. They cost money to rent, and there was no way the Treasury Department was going to spend money when it had several storage facilities and garages in Los Angeles. Murphy pointed out that transporting Jimmy to California would cost money, but their supervisor pointed out that it would actually be pretty cheap, since, as Murphy himself said, taking an airline flight home was impossible anyway. They quickly researched several possible ways to get Jimmy to L.A. without his magnetic field killing anyone. They considered renting the biggest truck they could and having him ride in the back, but his field would affect any car that tried to pass. They tried to talk their supervisor into renting an antique airplane, but any modern avionics would be useless, risking their safety, and worse, it would cost money. In the end, the boxcar was the only option. Since it is not actually legal to transport humans in a boxcar for any price, the agents had to sneak onto the train with Jimmy, and were now officially hobos, which cost nothing but their dignity. The one resource the Treasury Department was happy to squander with wild abandon. Murphy and Miller found a train that suited their purpose, then happily checked out of their room at the cheapest hotel in the SeaTac Airport District. Their boss had gotten a substantial discount by renting their room on a nightly basis instead of the usual hourly rate plan. They then had to transport Jimmy from the police headquarters to the rail yard, and they couldn't use any car that employed an integrated circuit because Jimmy would render it inoperable. In the end, an officer was able to loan them his early 70s Cadillac, which was barely operable to begin with. They transported Jimmy in the dead of night to minimize any effect he might have on traffic. The stealthy cloak-and-dagger feel of the operation was spoiled by the Cadillac's faulty wiring, which caused the horn to honk in time with the left turn signal. Agent Miller leaned back into the boxes and a miasma of self-pity.
"Maybe if I lay on my back," he thought, "I'll fall asleep. Then throw up and aspirate on my own sick. Then my body will slide between these cursed boxes and slowly sink down into squeaky oblivion."
He fantasized about this for a while. Then his backbone reasserted itself.
"No," he thought. "Without me here, Murphy will just be kind to Jimmy, and I can't allow that to happen. Not after all of this."
Miller forced himself to look out the door of the train. He watched the world pass, fast enough to keep him motion sick, but slow enough to give him no hope of arriving at his destination anytime soon. After a few moments, he saw a single hand swing in from beyond the door and clutch at its frame, knuckles white with exertion. Miller and Jimmy both scrambled as quickly as they dared toward the door. They had been traveling for nearly 2 days. This was the fourth time Murphy had made the transition from clinging to the side of the car to sitting inside, and it had already become routine. It was still utterly terrifying for everyone involved, but the terror was part of the routine. Just one more item on the checklist. Jimmy braced his legs on one side of the doorframe. Miller braced against the door itself. Murphy's second hand joined his first on the edge of the opening. Then the very top of his head appeared. He was now standing on the floor of the boxcar, but would not be able to climb up on the stack of boxes without help. Jimmy took one hand, Miller took the other, and with much pulling, kicking, and cursing, he was pulled up onto the surface like a landed fish.
What's the news?
Miller shouted. Murphy lay there, panting from the exertion and the stress. Between gulps of air, he yelled,
They have a facility set aside for us, and suitable transportation will be waiting at the rail yard's employee parking lot. All we have to do is wait for the cover of darkness, then sneak out past the railroad dicks.
Excellent,
Jimmy said.
This is great news. Smile, gentlemen. Things are going well.
That was the last straw. Miller shrieked,
Going well? I'm sick! I haven't slept more than a couple of hours in 2 days, and Murph is having to risk his life twice a day to talk to someone that we both avoid when we're in the same building as him. Then, to top it all off, we just found out that we're gonna have to slink into the city where we both live like criminals!
Yes!
Jimmy said.
Isn't it exciting?
Miller looked at Jimmy, who beamed at him. He looked at Murphy, who shrugged, as if to say, Well, he's got a point. Miller considered yelling at them both some more, but instead he simply relaxed and allowed himself to fall between the boxes. Down to the bottom of the squeaking cardboard crevasse. There, he hoped to find some peace. 17. Philip's trip to meet with Britt the Elder was actually rather pleasant. Once he realized that neither of the guards escorting him had any idea why she wanted to see him, their conversation turned to a more pleasant subject. Martin. Ampic spent the entire trip asking Philip pointed questions about Martin, questions Philip was happy to answer.
"He's impulsive," Philip said. He acts without thinking. He makes the same mistakes over and over, and when he finally does learn his lesson, he often forgets it within a few hours.
He sounds irritating,
Ampic said.
Oh, yes, he'll irritate you.
You don't seem to like him much.
On the contrary, he's quickly becoming my best friend,
Philip said.
If he's irritating and stupid, why be friends with him?
Oh, he's not stupid, just a slow learner. Stupid people are useless. Slow learners are tremendous fun to jerk around.
Finally, they arrived at Britt the Elder's patio, where he had first arrived in Atlantis just the day before. There was a table, two chairs, two empty glasses, and a pitcher of some refreshing-looking reddish drink. The two guards took their leave of Philip, telling him that Britt the Elder would be with him shortly. Philip walked to the railing and looked up at the city. It was getting close to evening. Due to the unique, bowl-like shape of Atlantis, most of the city was in shadow. Only one part of the city still had direct sunlight, a small crescent along the far upper rim. The darkness of the rest of town made it stand out even more. The sky was a brilliant blue disk overhead, and the city was dark and cool. Lights were slowly beginning to come on, just a few for now, but with each passing moment there were more, and as they did, the buildings themselves glowed. You could see light and shadow moving within the buildings, not so well that you could tell what was happening, but enough to let you know that something was going on, and that it seemed pleasant. Philip wondered about the lights. He knew that his quarters had artificial lights, Brits did as well. He knew that the vast majority of the people who lived in Atlantis didn't have the powers that he and his magical, time-traveling kind did. He wondered if they used candles, oil lamps, or some other lighting method he didn't know about. Philip was startled when a voice behind him said,
Magical.
He jumped, then spun around to see Britt the Elder standing behind him. He still couldn't get used to it. She had the same face, the same glasses. The hairstyle was different, but the hair color was the same.
The lights, Britt clarified. They're magical. Computer-generated, if you prefer to call it that.
She walked to the railing, standing closer to Philip than he was comfortable with. He was happy to have her stand that close, which is what made him uncomfortable.
Of course, Britt continued. All of their methods of creating light before I got here were variations on the theme of burning something. It's really dangerous and wasteful when you think about it. Instead, I set up light sources. You make a light, make a switch, tell the system that one controls the other. You know how it works. You used the same basic technique to make the lights in your rumpus room.
Philip looked down at her.
You've known about my rumpus room?
Britt replied,
Philip, I've ridden in your Fiero.
Philip noticed that she had the same smile as Britt the Younger as well.
Anyway, when people move to Atlantis, part of the bargain is that they get free light, heat, garbage, and waste removal. It's funny. I became a time traveler and a sorceress just to end up going into the utilities business.
So, all of the city's necessary functions are handled by magic,
Philip said.
That answers a lot of my questions. But don't the locals want to know how things work?
Did the modern people we left behind?
Philip said,
Yes, they did. The libraries were full of books about how every single thing in the world worked.
Britt took Philip by the arm and led him across the patio to the table. She did it so smoothly that he didn't even notice it was happening until they were almost there.
Yes, that's true,
Britt said.
But how many people actually read those books? How many know how to rewire a lamp or fix their own toilet?
They reached the table. Britt poured two glasses of whatever the reddish drink was, and they both had a seat. Britt continued.
People say that they want to know how things work, but really, most of them just want to know why things work.
Why they work?
Philip asked.
Yes,
Britt said.
You know, I flip the switch and the lamp turns on because of electricity. Or I put gas in the car, it burns and the car moves. Or I press this thingy, that thingy lights up because Britt made it work with magic. It's all the same to them. Please have a drink.
Britt took a long drink from her glass. Philip followed suit.
What is this?
He asked.
I see. I've loved the stuff ever since I was a kid.
Britt took another appreciative drink, then spent a moment silently studying Philip. Finally, she asked,
How'd you like the giant squid?
Philip was surprised. Then he was surprised at himself for being surprised.
The squid was amazing, he said. I could have done without the swim afterwards, though.
Yes,
Britt agreed.
Not a pleasant way to end the trip, but still memorable.
Clearly, since you seem to remember it,
Philip said. Every time Philip thought Britt's smile was as bright as it could be, it found a way to get a bit brighter.
Yes, I remember it well. I only took you to see the coral reef because it seemed like a nice, touristy kind of thing to show you. I was happy when it bored you. Your reaction to the squid made me even happier. It was good of you to listen to my whining. Sorry about that.
Philip bristled a bit.
I wouldn't call it whining. Britt the Younger has some legitimate complaints.
Britt the Elder shook her head.
Philip, there's no need to defend me to me. I know exactly what my complaints were. I made some good points. It certainly wasn't easy being Britt the Younger, but it's not really easy being anybody, is it? She thinks it's hard being her, but she hasn't tried being me yet.
You think you have it harder than she does?
Philip asked.
Not harder, just differently hard. You're what, 40 years old physically, 50 or so chronologically?
Yes.
Well, Britt the Younger and I are both 28 physically. She's 39 chronologically. I am 167. She's a little over a quarter my age. Think back to what you were like when you were 13.
Philip thought about it.
It was not pleasant. No need to tell me what you were like, Britt said. The grimace on your face says it all. Now imagine spending the next 50 years of your life living with you at age 13. Or to be fair, let's make it 20. Imagine watching 20-year-old Phil the Younger live the life you led, express the opinions that now make you wince, make the mistakes you remember painfully. Now imagine that you cannot, under any circumstances, interfere, because you know those experiences will make him the person he needs to become.
You.
Well, you in this example, but you're right. I am talking about me.
Philip thought for a moment, then said,
You make a good point, but that doesn't excuse all of your behavior. You're taking credit for her ideas.
I'm her, They're my ideas, too. And when I get credit for them, she gets it as well.
It doesn't feel that way to her.
Britt stood up.
Not yet, but it will.
She offered her hand.
Please come with me, Philip. There's something I'd like to show you.
Philip stood up, and again Britt the Elder deftly took him by the arm and led him, this time, down the steps of the patio and into the park that made up the center of the city. The sliver of the bowl that was still receiving direct sunlight was bathed in the orange glow that told Philip it was sunset. The reflected light gave the rest of the city a golden aura. Even more of the city's lights had come on, making the entire panorama surrounding them look like a patchwork quilt made out of light. The path through the park was lined with lights, but rather than being hung from poles, they were simply balls of pure white light suspended in space, casting a glow on the path beneath. As they walked, Philip said,
"If you remember our trip to see the squid..."
Britt looked up at him and interrupted.
"Like it was yesterday."
"It was today,"
Philip said.
"Anyway, then you'll remember my theory."
Philip expected that to sour her mood, but it did not. She said,
"You mean that I am not actually me?"
She let that hang in the air for a moment before correcting herself.
"Her, I mean."
"Yes," Philip said. "And I suppose you're going to tell me that I'm totally wrong."
"No, Philip, you're not totally wrong. I think you're about 50% wrong."
Philip said,
"Well, that's not so bad, I guess."
Britt said,
"I know that she told you how things happen from her point of view. Let me tell you how they happen from mine. I'll make it quick because most of it will sound familiar. I decided to come to Atlantis. I did some research, picked a time and place, and thought, if it isn't there already, I can always jump further back and build it myself. Then I made the jump, and the city, much as you see it now, was here waiting for me, along with a woman who claimed to be me, but older."
Philip said,
"But logically, if you built Atlantis, it can't have been here when you got here."
Britt reached up and poked Philip's nose.
"Exactly. I think you're right, Philip. I think the program did pause reality and did create an avatar of me that found no Atlantis here, then went back in time and built it according to how it knew I would. Then, when it got back to the point where I turned up, it restarted reality so I could experience it firsthand."
Philip said,
"But then after 50 years you go back in time to do what? Make Atlantis again?"
"No, I make Atlantis for the first time, exactly as the projection of me did before. The program knew exactly what I would do when it built it the first time. It's no surprise that when it was my turn, I did exactly the same thing."
"Interesting,"
Philip said.
"But still, how can you prove that you're really you and not a simulated you?"
"I can't. All I can tell you is that I am absolutely certain that I am me, that I used to be her, and that I know everything that has happened to us in the intervening time while she becomes me."
"Of course, that's exactly what a projection of you would say as well."
Britt looked up at Philip.
"Do I look like a computer projection to you?"
"Yes, but everybody does, because we both know that that's what we are."
Britt squeezed his arm and said,
"Touché."
They walked on in silence for a few moments. Philip saw that they were walking toward the monument that stood in the middle of the park. It was a polished white spire that rose from the center of the park, which was itself the center of the city. It gave the impression of being the spindle around which the city revolved. Philip asked Britt the Elder where they were going.
"Exactly where it looks like we're going,"
she said.
"Philip, I owe you an apology. I've misled you. A long time ago, earlier today to you, I told you that me, was taking credit for her ideas. There's some truth to that, but what I didn't say at the time was that I only really had 2 ideas.
"What?"
Philip said, stopping in his tracks.
"You built this entire city. I mean, Britt the Younger's point is that she had all of the ideas that you built the city with, and that you got the credit for it. Are you telling me that you built this place with only 2 ideas?
Britt laughed pleasantly and started leading Philip forward again.
No, not at all. It took hundreds of ideas to make this place work. All I'm saying is, at the time that I transported back to this time in the first place, I had only had two of them. Fabricating objects one atom at a time using automated algorithms, and using those objects to create complex mechanisms with few or no actual moving parts. I liked the simplicity of it. It felt very Charles Eames to me. Anyway, I got here and the city was already built, so I just took notice of how everything worked. Later, when I went back in time and started building, I realized how many details there were and how many problems needed to be solved. So I had to fall back on the things I remembered from when I was Brit the Younger.
Are you saying that the ideas just sort of spontaneously happened, and thanks to the loop in your timeline, it's impossible to know which of you came up with them?
Philip asked.
No,
Brit said and stopped walking. I know exactly who came up with the ideas. They were directly in front of the obelisk now. At its base, there was a squared section, covered with engraved writing. Brit let go of Philip's arm, gestured toward the monument, and said,
"Go read what it says."
Philip walked toward the monument, eventually getting close enough to make it out. It read, "The city of Atlantis would neither exist nor function without the contributions of the following people." Beneath that were a great many names, listed in alphabetical order. Philip scanned the list. He, Martin, and Gwen were all listed, as were Jeff and, strangely, Jeff's trainee Roy. As he read, Brit walked up beside him.
When I first got here and saw this list, I figured it was just people who had been supportive or offered the occasional bit of advice. It wasn't until I actually started building the place that I realized these are all people from whom I copied some idea, some bit of code, some functioning idea, and incorporated it into the city.
Philip turned on Brit.
You mean you stole ideas from all of these people?
Brit just smiled.
I don't think stole is the right word, Philip. You've made all of your work available to the wizards in your community to use. You haven't attempted to patent anything. You're not exploiting any of your ideas for profit. Except for creating money from thin air, of course, but you're hardly the only one of us to come up with that. I am giving you credit. Part of this summit's purpose is so I can talk to the leader of each group and show them the monument. If I wanted to steal ideas, I could just claim to have thought of them first. After all, I did use them first.
Philip put up a hand to stop her.
Okay, you're right. I'm sorry. I'm a little sensitive about people taking credit for my ideas.
Brit took his arm again and squeezed it reassuringly.
I know. It's one of the things you and younger me had in common. You'll notice that your old friend Jimmy's name isn't on there.
Good,
Philip said.
So what ideas of mine did you end up using?
Two things. One, you know the interface you created to help you manipulate the file? You call it the shell. We call ours the interface. But if you look at it, you'll see that it functions in much the same way. That's an idea that has caught on much more widely than I think you know. All of the communities have some version of it. Some even use chunks of your original source code.
Really?
A good idea spreads fast.
Philip liked the idea that he had made life better for many people. He couldn't resist asking,
"What's the other idea you used?"
Brit smirked and said,
"You mean you haven't noticed the lavatories? All of the restrooms in the city work on the same principle as the one in your home."
Philip's facilities consisted of a simple latrine with a 30-foot pit. But at the bottom of the pit, there was a portal that instantly transported anything that fell through it away. Where away had changed recently because a statue he particularly disliked had been removed. Currently, away was a local farmer's fertilizer supply, which the farmer appreciated, although he was not pleased with the velocity with which the fresh fertilizer would arrive. It led to his fertilizer pile being messier than he liked, a concept which fascinated Philip.
"Where do your lavatories lead?"
Philip asked. Brit asked,
"You haven't had a chance to look at the stars at night since you got here, have you?"
"No."
"I suggest you and younger me do so.
Not tonight, as I remember. I'm still a little shaken, what with someone repeatedly trying to kill me and all. But soon. I think you'll notice that we have quite a few more shooting stars than you're used to.
Now that you know why, I doubt you'll find it as romantic as you would have before.
They walked in silence for a moment, giving Philip the opportunity to notice that she had started leading him away from the monument and back to her patio. They were most of the way back,